Convene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We're delighted to welcome a class from Oregon High School. The students, please stand. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin in this court, cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If the class accepts the invitation, then the students are given materials about this case and may engage in activities relating to this case. They then come to the court, listen to the oral argument, and meet with a justice of the court after this second oral argument. Everyone is invited to join the students in meeting with the justice, and the discussion will be about the procedures of the court, not the substance or the substantive issues that the case presents. The students have gotten material about the case. Is there anyone else in the room who would like a synopsis of the case? It's easier to hear and understand the argument if you know what the facts and the legal issues are. If you raise your hand, we'll give you a synopsis. Okay. Now that we've met the students, let me introduce the court to all of you. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. You will meet with her after this oral argument is completed. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call the second case this morning, 088P-1011CR, State versus James Smith. Arguing on behalf of James Smith is Shelley Feit, Assistant State Public Defender. Counsel?
May it please the court. My name is Shelley Feit, and I represent James Smith. Smith has never committed a sex crime, but Wisconsin Section 301.45 requires him to register as a sex offender. The central legal question before this court is whether this is rational. In this opening statement, I will very briefly describe Mr. Smith's claims, and then I want to talk a little bit about the as-applied nature of those claims. 301.45 defines the term sex offense to include the crime of false imprisonment of a minor, if not by a parent. Mr. Smith was convicted of this crime when, at age 17, he made another 17-year-old drive him in search of money to pay off a drug debt. So his crime was not sexual, but 301.45 called it a sex offense and requires Mr. Smith to register as a sex offender. So this case is about whether this application of law, the requirement that Mr. Smith register as a sex offender, though he did not commit a sex crime, violates his right to substantive due process and equal protection. Now, for any due process claim, the threshold question is whether there's been a deprivation of liberty or property. Mr. Smith discussed his liberty interests in his opening brief, but the state has never argued this point, and I'm going to set it aside for right now and turn to the ultimate legal question, which is the same under both the substantive due process and the equal protection clauses, and that is whether applying 301.45 to Mr. Smith is rationally related to any legitimate objective. Now, the Court of Appeals and the state have proposed different rational bases in this case. The Court of Appeals found that the application here was rationally related to the objective of protecting children from violence because Mr. Smith committed a violent crime against a minor. In its brief to this court, the state also suggested a few rational bases based on the objective that Mr. Smith has proposed as the only one that works with the text of the statute, and that is protecting the public and assisting law enforcement regarding sexually motivated criminals. Specifically, the states argued that false imprisonment is linked to sexual assault, it's difficult to determine whether false imprisonment has a sexual component, and that crime makes a victim sexually vulnerable. Now, I want to talk about each of these rational bases individually, but first I'm going to group them together because they could all support 301.45 subsection 1D subsection B on its face. And that's the subsection that includes false imprisonment of a minor among the list of sex offenses. But Mr. Smith has only raised as applied claims. He has never argued that any part of 301.45 is facially unconstitutional or that this court should strike any part of it down.
Let me ask you a question on just the point you made. Why wouldn't you say that this is a facial challenge when you look at the fact that in the statute there's specific mention of the false imprisonment statute of 940.30? So why draw the distinction between as applied as against a facial challenge?
Well, the legislature is free to make a presumption that anyone convicted of false imprisonment of a minor who's not a parent has committed a sexually motivated crime. And the state and Mr. Smith agree on the legislative history here, and that's essentially what they were doing. But what we're talking about here is a single individual, and that is Mr. Smith, and the facts of his case. This court has talked about in discussing the as-applied standard that we're not looking at hypothetical scenarios. We're looking at the particular facts of the case. And under the particular facts of this case, that presumption that is perhaps facially appropriate doesn't work here. And that's why we have to look at, again, Mr. Smith's case. So it's not a facial claim. Now, the state agrees with Mr. Smith on the law applied to as-applied claims, and it's stated the standard correctly, but at the same time, it's inviting this court to basically treat this case like a facial claim. And I think that's exactly what the courts did in Illinois and New York in the cases that the state cited. They discussed the standard for an as-applied claim, but in the end, they looked at general reasons that you could connect kidnapping and false imprisonment to crimes of sexual assault in order to find the statutes rational. Now, of course, the other cases that Mr. Smith cited, including those out of Florida and Ohio, not only discussed the as-applied standard, but in those cases applied that standard to the appellants in those cases who had committed clearly non-sexual crimes. And they were able to say that for those individual defendants, it was irrational to require them to register as a sex offender because it was not related to any legitimate objective.
Seems to me the state goes further and says, in effect, this really isn't a sexual offender registry. It doesn't use the term sexual offender except in the title. That this is a general protection against violence, and you don't have to limit it to sexual offenses.
Right, and that seems to sort of be what the Court of Appeals was saying too. That there's the registry goes to sex offenses; it also goes to these other kinds of offenses. I dispute that. It is a sex offender registry, and that's not about the title of the statute. It only applies to crimes that the statute defines as a sex offense or other crimes that were sexually motivated. And now the term sex offense, you know, has a meaning, and that meaning is an offense that is a certain type of offense.
Can I interrupt you for a moment? Help me out here. I just want to make sure, because I didn't go through all the statutes, but I've gone through a number of them. Under sub B, where it defines sex offense, it talks about a violation of a variety of 940, 944, 948 statutes and subsections, right? Do all of those that precede the word or, are all those sex crimes?
Precede the word or. Yes, every one of those is a crime that has a sexual element. The only exception being 948.30, which is effectively identical to kidnapping, if not by a parent, kidnapping of a minor, if not by a parent, because that's the specific statute applicable to abduction of another's child.
And there's an or that precedes that one too, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So, of what import, if any, do you think the word or in the statute has?
I guess I'm not sure what your question is going to.
Well, it defines sex offense means a violation or attempt to do the following, and then lists a whole variety of offenses that within the term of the offense have sexual assault or exposing a child or sexual exploitation by a therapist or a whole variety of them that clearly involve some sexual element, right? And then it has or kidnapping or false imprisonment. And I'm just wondering if you think that was just random, or if the word or has any particular meaning, or what your thoughts were, if any. And then the second part of my question relates to what you were just talking about, which is throughout the, other than the title, throughout the statute, it refers to reporting requirements generally. It doesn't say sexual offender registration or sexual offender reporting requirements. And I'm wondering if your argument is valid, why didn't the legislature use the title throughout the statute if the legislature meant to include only sex offender registration or that sexual element?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't presume to know why they used the precise term in each place. I certainly think that by defining every crime that comes within the statute as a sex offense, that alone makes it a sex offender registry. If you commit a sex offense, by definition, you are a sex offender. And then throughout, in other places in the code, in Mr. Smith's brief, mentioned other places that refer back to this statute and do exclusively refer to it as the sex offender registry. I just think that there's no way to rationally refer to this as a registry about crimes against children or violent crimes. And this is even though the Jacob Wetterling Act that this statute is based on, it was different from that act. It was about two different kinds of offenses. It was about sexual offenses. It was also about violent offenses against children. And it essentially laid out different crimes that if an offender was convicted of those crimes, the state wanted the states to collect those people's information and turn it over to the FBI, among other things. But they didn't tell the states how to put the statute together. And what Wisconsin did is they essentially folded what the Jacob Wetterling Act was requesting of the states into its existing sex offender registry and just called them all sex offenses and all the people who committed those crimes sex offenders.
Well, did Wisconsin have to include the kidnapping in its sexual, in a registry under the Federal Act?
Under the Federal Act, if they wanted to receive federal funds, they needed to collect information from people who committed those offenses. Now, different states set up their registries in different ways. Others created registries where they had a sex offender registry and then a separate registry for people who commit different kinds of crimes against children. Some created a much broader registry, a felon registry, a violent offender registry, but that's not what Wisconsin did, and what we are talking about is Wisconsin's sex offender registry, and the irrationality of requiring someone who never committed any offense with a sexual element or motivation on that sex offender registry.
Well, the federal statute doesn't require what Wisconsin did.
No,
it may require something, but not Wisconsin did.
Correct.
So it's not like we were mandated to do this by Congress.
No, absolutely not. And we weren't, Congress didn't require anybody to do anything at all. Of course, it was a matter of funds, but it certainly didn't even ask states to create the kind of registry that Wisconsin created here. And I think most of this has gone to what the Court of Appeals gave as its proposed rational basis for the law. One other thing that I want to point out about the Court of Appeals decision is that it also misstated the standard for substantive due process. It referred to the shock to conscience test. That's the test that's applicable to executive action like police brutality. So that's not applicable here. I just want to make sure to get that in. And then
what do you think is the test?
The test is whether the application of law to Mr. Smith is rationally related to a legitimate government interest, to a legitimate government objective.
And doesn't your client have the response and the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that it does not?
Correct, Your Honor. Now, the state's proposed relationships...
Before you get to this,
sure,
the state's argument, just let me firm up what your argument is. Your argument is false imprisonment alone, especially under the facts of this case where it's a drug, collecting a drug debt, right? They took the minor, falsely imprisoned the minor to collect a drug debt. Nothing to do with sex. Your position is that as applied to your client, that cannot be a sex offense, right?
Correct.
Okay. And tell me when you believe false imprisonment would qualify as a sex offense and what would have to be proven. Would it always have to be charged with another sex offense? Or what kind of sexual component would there have to be for false imprisonment to be deemed a sex offense? That's why I'm trying to figure out where you are on that scale. Because the facts of this case, clearly no sex was involved.
Well, to answer directly as to whether there would need to be a sexual assault or something like that charged, absolutely not. This is a very narrow question before the court, and Mr. Smith is asking for a very narrow reading. The legislature is allowed to presume that someone who committed the crime of false imprisonment of a minor who is not his parent is in fact a sex offender. The question is, a defendant who comes forward and raises the issue with the trial court and can show that the record can show that his case was clearly non-sexual, whether he can prove that the law is unconstitutional as applied to him. So, you know, if we're looking at future defendants, this is not going to change how future defendants can be charged, how they can be prosecuted, how they can be asked to put on the registry. But if an individual defendant can meet the burden of showing that his cases are essentially identical to Mr. Smith's, and that is, in an as-applied claim, you're looking at other claims that are basically identical, then they can go forward and meet their burden of proving that their case is identical and the statute is also unconstitutional as applied to them.
So it depends on the day and depends on the facts, and the court will just have to sift that out as future cases come through?
Absolutely. And trial courts do this already. I believe it's 973.048, where it's sentencing and imposing the sex offender registration requirement for crimes that are not among the enumerated sex offenses. They have to make a determination on whether one of these other crimes was sexually motivated. So this is something that trial courts are used to doing, and the difference here would be that the burden would be on the defendant to raise it in a case like this and show, again, that it is unconstitutional as applied to him because it's irrational.
So if you had a charge of false imprisonment and a sexual offense, and it was fled down to just false imprisonment, and all sex matters were eliminated, you could still go on the registry because the record would show that there was a sex offense motivation in there or an actual sex offense.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's your position.
Correct. And I would even go a little bit farther than that and say, you know, we can imagine a case where someone falsely imprisons a child and the crime is interrupted before it's completed, and we're not really sure what was going on, what the person's motivation was. I certainly don't think that the rule, or not the rule, but the decision that Mr. Smith is asking for from this court would keep a trial court from requiring that person to register as a sex offense, because they would, again, have the burden to show what else was going on. Now, for Mr. Smith, it's not just that he didn't sexually assault a child. He had a different motivation for the crime that's clear from the record, and that motivation is money. And he also completed the crime. He left the victim at the end of the night once he received a promise for money, and the victim and the co-defendant spent the rest of the night, I believe, watching television and going to a party. So this is not the kind of case where we're not really sure what was going on. It's clear from the record that it was not a sexually motivated crime. And frankly, that may be a rare case. There's no way for me to look up the instances, each instance of false imprisonment and kidnapping, to see, you know, how many of those may or may not be sexually motivated. But in this case, for Mr. Smith, the law is irrational as applied to him. Now, this also gets to the state's proposed relationships, which I think most directly go to the facial constitutionality of the particular subsection, including false imprisonment. The link between false imprisonment and sexual assault, again, you know, we agree that that's exactly what Congress and the legislature were thinking here, but it's not applicable to this case for all of the facts that that I've just shared. Also, the difficulty of determining whether any false imprisonment was sexual, that goes to what I was just talking about, where a crime might be interrupted and we're not really sure of the motivation. Well, here we can be sure of the motivation because the record is very clear that this is not a sexual crime. The nature of the victim, the nature of the offender, and exactly what happened that night, none of it would suggest any motivation other than money.
That kind of brings me back to my question again, though. If you have, let's just assume you have somebody who's not collecting a drug debt. The person has every intent as a pedophile to go out, abducts a child, but doesn't yet act on that. But that was in that person's mind. But you, as the state, you really can't prove that, right? That person, under your logic, would not have to apply, right? Because there'd be no way, or report, because there'd be no way for anyone to prove that was a sexually related abduction. Do you think the government has a legitimate interest in protecting minors from being abducted by other people?
The answer to that question is yes.
Yeah. Well, there are two different
answers. So when you have a legislature that decides that those people ought to register, you're saying there's no legitimate governmental interest in that?
Well, you're raising two different questions. The first one is whether someone who the state can't prove was sexually motivated would be able to end up on the registry. And because this is an as-applied claim, again, this is not going to automatically exclude anyone from the registry. And so the burden is not going to be on the state to prove that any given defendant was sexually motivated. I think it was the New York court that essentially phrased the claims of the defendants in that way, that the state hadn't proven that they were sexually motivated. In this case, what we're talking about is a defendant who can affirmatively show that he was not sexually motivated and meet his constitutional burden to show that the statute is irrational as applied to him. So we're looking at something very different. And then the second question as to whether the legislature has a legitimate objective in protecting children from abduction, absolutely. I don't think anyone would argue with that. But that doesn't change the irrationality of calling a non-sexual offender a sex offender and requiring him to register as a sex offender, which is what 301.45 does in this case.
You're saying registering as a sex offender doesn't reach the objective to protect children?
Absolutely. The requiring Mr. Smith to register as a sex offender. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not challenging the sex offender registration scheme in general, and I'm also not challenging The offense-based sex offender registration scheme, which is what Wisconsin has chosen to create, we are only talking about whether Mr. Smith, a non-sexual offender, can rationally be required to register as a sex offender.
Well, isn't the state, aren't you really saying the state's legitimate objective is to protect children from sex abuse?
I'm sorry, would you repeat?
Aren't you arguing that the objective of this statute is to protect children from sexual abuse?
Correct. I think that there are...
Not to protect children generally.
Right. There are two arguments here. The first argument is that this statute is not just protecting the public, except to the extent that, you know, the entire criminal code is to protect the public. The point of this statute is to protect children and also adults
right.
from sexual violence. But then, aside from that, the second response to that is that, you know, even if this court agrees with the state that this is just some general protecting children from violence, then even in that case, there's simply no rational basis for requiring Mr. Smith to register as a sex offender. It doesn't achieve anything toward protecting children from violence, and if anything, it's going to confuse and mislead the public. It's going to fill the sex offender registry with people that, frankly, don't fit with the label it's giving people. And, you know, I disagree with the state that what I'm talking about there is a policy dispute for the legislature. That goes directly to the rationality of this law, which is the constitutional question here.
So the court, in order to reach a decision in this case, has to first determine what the state objective is.
Correct.
And then determine whether requiring your client under the facts of this case is rationally related to achieve this objective.
Absolutely.
So the more general you state the objective, the more people come under it.
Sure, but again, we have to look at the relationship. And now, the rational basis test is a very deferential test. So we don't have to have a perfect fit between any application and and any objective that this court comes up with for the law. But you have to come up with some fit. You have to come up with a rational relationship. And here, for Mr. Smith, there is no fit. So yeah, it's true. If you define an objective generally, you can get everybody under it, but you still have to have the relationship.
The state, seems to me, defines it as objective to protect children from crime and to help law enforcement, right? Because if it's registered, then you can find them, picture is there, etc. So if you want to help law enforcement, if that's the state's objective, then they can put, the state can add anybody to this registry.
Sure. Under the state's logic, you could put anybody who forges a check on the sex offender registry. But I would submit that is not rational. It is a sex offender registry. It is not a felon registry. And the more people you put on the registry, the better the registry does not get. I see that my time is up. I don't know if there are any more questions.
Well, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Representing the state is Assistant Attorney General Rebecca Lapp St. John. Counsel?
Please report. To prevail in this case, James Smith must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the legislature lacked any conceivable rational basis for making him register as a sex offender. He has not done that. Smith has to register because he was convicted of falsely imprisoning a minor. The state has identified three reasons why the legislature could have rationally included false imprisonment of a minor on the list of offenses for which registration is mandatory, and explained that those reasons are rationally related to legitimate government purposes.
Well, that goes to the spatial challenge, though, doesn't it?
No, I think there's sort of two responses to that. First, I don't agree with Mr. Smith's view of what an as-applied challenge is in the context of rational basis review. If you go through the rational basis review case law, there's sort of two points that come out. One, precision and mathematical niceties are not required. I talked about two cases in my brief, Radke and McManus, but I want to point the court to a couple other ones as well. The first one is the case State v. Jadrowski. It involved whether a strict liability statutory rape law could be applied to a defendant in a case in which the victim had allegedly intentionally misrepresented her age. This court recognizes the legislature has broad powers to define criminal offenses in exercise of its police power, and it recognizes strict liability furthers the legitimate government interest in protecting children from sexual abuse by placing risk of mistake on the adult actor. The second case is Lewis v. United States, and that's at 445 U.S. 55. Involved the constitutionality of a federal firearms statute prohibiting felons from possessing firearms. The United States Supreme Court held that that passed rational basis review. It recognized that federal gun laws, the focus is not on reliability, but on the mere fact of conviction or indictment to keep firearms away from potentially dangerous people. In both of these cases, sort of recognizes that the legislature is allowed to make generalizations and have groups.
Go to the three rationales in your brief. And my sense was those rationales, and even as you set them out, were rationales for on its face or facial. And then you, in discussion, also discuss the applied. The first rationale is set forth on page 13, and that is false imprisonment is linked to the commission of sexual assault and other violence against children. And then you address the application to Mr. Smith on page 17, and this is what you say on page 17, in focusing that rationale on the as-applied challenge here. You say the first rationale applies to Smith even though his act of false imprisonment was never alleged or proven to be sexual. Smith demonstrated through his actions that he is a high-risk individual who may have a greater propensity to commit sexual or other dangerous crimes against children. Additionally, it's impossible to know for sure whether Smith or his co-actors would not have sexually assaulted the minor they falsely imprisoned, either for personal arousal or just to humiliate or control the minor if the opportunity had arisen. Your opposing counsel indicates, hey, look, this is a fact, this is a story completed. They kidnapped him, the motive was money, got the money, and so we don't have to worry about knowing for sure whether Smith or his co-actors would not have sexually assaulted.
Well, the state's initial position is that the facts underlining Mr. Smith's case do not matter. The legislature can create a class of people and require them to register because it has rational reasons for thinking people commit these crimes should register for all the reasons I give in my brief. But beyond that, though the crime was complete.
Just a minute. The facts of a case don't matter in an as-applied challenge?
I think that if you look at the case law about mathematical nicety, when they talk about mathematical nicety and they accept some generalizations, that the actual facts don't matter. In rational basis review, we're seeing if there's any conceivable basis for legislation. In the case law, the two cases I just discussed, and in Radke and McManus, they talk about allowing some generalizations. There's also some other cases. One is State v. Quintana.
Am I wrong in thinking that an as-applied challenge is just shorthand for as applied to the defendant and the facts in this case? Isn't that what as-applied means? Maybe I'm wrong. I guess I've always thought that that's what as-applied, otherwise it's facial.
I agree, and I sort of thought that too, but I'm realizing in looking at the cases, there's not a one-size-fits-all as-applied challenge. So what you do in that Hamdi case that I cited, when it's looking specifically at the way that the individual liberties were infringed upon versus rational basis review, where you're seeing if there's any conceivable rational basis for legislation, you have to look at as applied a little bit differently. The view of as applied, where you're looking at specific individuals, seems to be inching very close to strict scrutiny, which is not required when a fundamental liberty interest isn't involved.
Well, maybe cases that I've written got to be reversed then. Because I always thought as applied meant as applied to the facts of this case. Let's take your second rationale. That's set out on page 18. The rationale that is that the purpose that is the legitimate, rationally related to the legitimate government objective. And this is the second objective, the second reason. It's set out on page 18. It's difficult to determine whether false imprisonment had a sexual component. And then at the very bottom of page 18, you apply it to the facts of this case. And you say in the last paragraph on page 18 of your brief, the second rationale applies to Smith, even though nothing overtly sexual is described in the criminal complaint on which Smith's plea and conviction are based. And I say, okay, well, why is that? And you say, criminal complaint aside, it is impossible to get inside Smith's head or to know why he did what he did, how he felt when he was doing it, and what he thinks about it now.
I'd like to, there's a couple points about this. One, to the extent in my brief, I cited Hamden, and I was focused on the individual. I'd just like to clarify what the state's position about as-applied challenges are in the rational basis review context.
Is this, just for my help and clarification, are you saying that you're departing now from what your brief is? Because I yielded the third rationale and then how you discussed how it was applied. Are you changing a little bit, or are you just clarifying? I mean, what are you doing?
Clarifying,
okay.
Right.
Good enough.
So there's a couple points. One, for rational basis review, I talked about how the legislature can generalize. Also in this Quintana case, and then there's a New York case, New York versus Knox, they talk about not only does the legislature have authority to generalize a little bit and have classes, it may also be rational for the legislature to do that. I'd just like you to refer you to a case of New York versus Knox. The legislature went through the rational basis review of false imprisonment, sort of like I did in my brief, but then it went on to ask the separate question, well, why not separate out people like Mr. Smith, who didn't have any clear sexual intent? And it said, in deciding not to exclude defendants and others similarly situated from the category of sex offenders, the legislature could have considered not only cases where the term is unremitted or a few, or where the term is unmerited or few, but also the process of separating those cases from the majority in which it is justified, in which justified is difficult, cumbersome, and prone to error. It could have been rational, it could have rationally found that the administrative burden and risk that some dangerous sex offenders would escape registration justified a hard and fast rule with no exceptions.
So it's getting rid of the as-applied test. That's what it's saying. Maybe too hard to deal with the individual, so we're just doing facial. Facial? No, I would agree with the state. Facially, you've got a objective against children. False imprisonment makes them vulnerable to sexual offense. You can throw it in. But what you're asking this court to do is get rid of the as applied, because you're going right back to the general rule, which I agree is the general rule. Doesn't have to be a perfect match. Doesn't have to be all inclusive. Can exclude sexual offenses if it wants to. And you're just saying it's too hard to look at the individual, so the legislature could just discard it.
I'm saying that would be a rational basis for the legislature. In terms of the as applied, I think there's a big tension between what rational basis review is in the case law and what as applied the language is about looking at the individual. And I think if you really start focusing on individuals in every case, you're going to end up with strict scrutiny, effectively.
So you're going to just get rid of liberty interests for individuals. They don't have to have a rational basis for taking away liberty interests.
I do think you have to have a rational basis, but I think the legislature has authority under the Constitution to categorize people and to make generalizations. It can say, we're going to make statutory rape a strict liability crime. It can say we're going to have 1,000 feet around a school is going to be a school zone, and we don't care whether kids are there or not there, whether the crime happens inside or outside. The legislature can make some of those generalizations. I also want to get back to the point, let's assume that the court says, no, that's not right. As applied, are focused on the individual. Well, Mr. Smith says, well, the facts are all developed because I completed my crime, but that's not entirely true. He pled no contest to the false imprisonment crime. The crime, the facts surrounding that false imprisonment were never fully developed. And if you look in the transcripts that he provided in the Court of Appeals, the sentencing transcripts and probation revocation sentencing transcript, it's clear that the facts were not fully developed. There was a lot of debate about whether there was a firearm, whether he was a ringleader. The prosecutor said in the probation revocation sentencing transcript that they ended up pleading the case down because the victim didn't want to testify. So,
counsel? I had a chance to ask Ms. White these questions, and this is segueing into the kinds of questions I asked her, and that is, if we adopt her point of view with respect to the facts here as alleged don't involve a sex offense, and as applied, this statute is unconstitutional as to Mr. Smith, how is it then in the future we'll know if some part of some crime involves a sex offense, unless a sex offense or some part of that is alleged in a complaint? And the state has a duty not to bring charges that are that you can't support, right? So someone may have, there might be a sexual component to kidnapping, false imprisonment. It's not that uncommon. You just open the newspaper. Crazy, terrible things happen all the time. But whether or not the state could prove a sexual charge beyond a reasonable doubt, especially if one isn't actually accomplished and the state happens to find the perpetrator before that occurs, how will we know when someone should be deemed to have committed a sex offense and when they shouldn't? And how do we know the legislature didn't just say, you know what, these are so egregious and they involve kidnapping, they involve false imprisonment of a minor, and those cases turn out bad all the time, where it turns bad, and if these perpetrators aren't caught early, oftentimes end up in a sex-type crime. We're just going to err on the side of protecting the kids when we draft the statute. Tell me what you think of that, and how the state would ever prove, you know, without a jury trial and a full factual hearing, even beyond a jury trial, mm-hmm. that could go beyond what you allege in the complaint under the logic of the defense. How does the state think?
I think that's a good point. Mr. Smith really emphasizes this is an as-applied challenge. It's very narrow. It won't affect a lot of other cases. It's only this case or people exactly like that. But I think the practical consequences of this would be very real. In Connecticut Department of Safety versus Doe, the United States Supreme Court said with a similar offense-based registry that giving process to determine, for example, whether someone had a propensity to reoffend would be a bootless exercise because it was an offense-based registry. But if you took on or if you accepted Mr. Smith's view of what an as-applied challenge was, you'd have to have some sort of process or fact-finding to determine who could register and who could not. It would create a third category of offenses. Instead of just having mandatory offenses and discretionary offenses, there'd be a category that are, there's a presumption of registration, but they can prove they don't have to. And in these, the burden would be on Mr. Smith to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he met the criteria and wasn't sexually motivated and didn't commit a sexual crime. The procedural history would make fact-finding difficult because he pled no contest. The facts were never developed. And he didn't challenge the registration when it was ordered. He's waited to collect, like, to attack it now that he's been convicted for not complying. So you could have a case where victims, for example, are coming back years and years later having to provide testimony about the nature and the specifics of crimes. There's the evidentiary difficulty that I discussed on page 18 of my brief.
Didn't he raise here, in the back of my mind, I have that he raised sentencing this constitutional question. Am I wrong on that in this case?
He's sentencing in the reporting conviction or in the false imprisonment case?
False imprisonment.
I don't remember him raising anything about this in the false imprisonment conviction.
How about the other conviction?
He raised it when he was initially charged with the report.
Say that again, please.
Charged with violating the reporting statute, that's when he brought up this constitutional claim that he could not be required to register. So there's the evidentiary difficulty of showing and proving what exactly happened in a crime, especially when you have crimes with children. But also there's the legal determination. What is sexual motivation? And there's some cases like there's a Johnson case, 870 Northeast 2nd, 415 from Illinois. There, somebody abducted a grandmother and a granddaughter and took off the grandmother's clothes, not for any sexual motivation, but just to keep her from leaving the scene. Or you could imagine a situation where Smith or one of his fellow participants in the crime just tapped the rear or did something just to humiliate the victim in this case that could be sexual but may not have done it for sexual motivation. And then you get
involved anyway.
And then there's a slippery slope. If you allow it in this case because he wasn't sexually motivated, what about somebody who's one day too old to fall under the underage exception for sexual activity? That person's probably not a sexual predator like you think, but it's just the questions and the different types of questions that can be raised in these procedures would be huge.
This isn't a sexual predator statute.
No, this court has defined the purpose of the statute as assisting law enforcement and protecting the public. And in the Bolick case, in which is one of the cases that cited that it actually got into the legislative history, I think it's also interesting. The statute's not just it's not the title, technically, and it's not just what you call the person. It's the statute as a whole. And when you look at it, this statute doesn't provide for people going to sex offender treatment or doing anything like that. It's really a collection of information and then a dissemination of that information.
But all those statutes relate to sex offenses.
Most of the crimes do relate to things.
Ones don't, other than false imprisonment.
There's false imprisonment, there's kidnapping, and then there's constructive custody.
Yeah, but all of them have the same element of taking that child. They all relate to children, right?
Right.
Not adults.
Right.
What would happen if the legislature put 940-19 battery into the definition of sex offense?
I think you get back to the question of whether the legislature has the authority to take a crime that does not have a sexual element and put it in the registry. So that you get back to the same rational basis analysis I was doing. And that then, I think, could depend on how you define the purpose or conceivable legitimate purpose of the statute.
So they could put in burglary in a house.
Potentially they could, and you could make an argument for why that would be rationally related to whatever purpose you define. Now, whether they would do that.
Protect people and help law enforcement. Putting them on the registry would be very helpful.
Right.
Depends on how broadly you define the purpose. You get the whole criminal statute book in there.
Right. And I want to clarify when I'm making this argument. The state respects the fact that being called a sex offender is a serious label, so I'm not trying to minimize that. This question here is just whether there's a rational basis for including certain crimes mandatorily in the registration scheme. Mm-hmm.
What's the liberty interest?
The liberty interest is not being subjected to arbitrary and irrational laws. There's a treatise. I know it's not as good as a case, but it's a Rotunda and Novak treatise, and they say there's no need to define life, property, or liberty for substantive due process analysis, although some Supreme Court cases would lead a reader to believe to the contrary. All laws might be said to restrict individuals' use of property rights or personal liberty in the sense of restricting which actions the individual can take in society. Laws regulating property or liberty that do not restrict the exercise of a fundamental right should be upheld unless the person attacking the law can overcome the presumption of constitutionality and demonstrate that the law is not rationally related to a legitimate government interest. So that's what the interest is here.
What is it?
It's not to be subjected to an irrational and arbitrary law.
This is a heavy consequence, and well, it should be for those
who are sexual offenders, and particularly child sexual offenders. When I was preparing for this case, and I thought of sex offenders, you know, we all wear several hats. I'm a judge, I wear a robe, but I also am a mother. And I thought, and I'm a person who lives in a neighborhood, and I thought to myself, because I didn't, when I was thinking, I didn't have my robe on, so I was thinking as a mother and a person who lives in a neighborhood. And I thought to myself, would I want my kids in elementary school playing with the children of someone who is on a sex offense registry? And I can tell you, right or wrong, my response was no. Now that's really unfair, but I'm telling you, that's what my gut response was. And why? Because I would want no chance whatsoever that my kids would ever go over to that house. I wouldn't risk that as a mother. Right? And what about having someone live in my neighborhood? Let's say next door, because I apparently do have some living in my neighborhood. Living next door. Would I want my kids, would I want to develop a relationship with that family? No. Would I want my kids to be on their grass, to be on their property? No. Now, I'm not proud of necessarily saying that, but I'm saying I will protect my kids, period. And so this is a real stigma. And obviously not to be taken lightly on any side, right? The kidnapping here is defined as the false imprisonment here is defined as a sex offense under the statute. Is that your position? Is it not your position? And if I understand your argument, and this is a little perplexing to me, you are arguing that that there's really no such thing as an as-applied constitutional challenge. It's really on rational basis. It's all strict scrutiny. Is that what you're saying? And if so, are you saying it just in the context of sexual stuff, or is that broadly? Is that in the context of termination of parental rights cases, too? Where are you going with that?
Well, it wouldn't mean a termination of parental rights case. I was actually reading those cases that made me begin to think that what she was doing with her as, or what Mr. Smith was doing with his as-applied challenge was really getting very close to strict scrutiny. When you read cases like Max, GW, or the Kelly B case, they're very focused on the individual circumstances of cases.
They are very focused on the facts. And when you say the individualized circumstances of the cases, to me that's just fancy for saying they're focused on the facts. And yet you earlier said that the facts are not necessarily important here.
I think the facts are important to the extent. I think when you look at what rational basis review is, it is looking at whether there's a conceivable rational basis for legislation. In this case, it's that there's false imprisonment. The legislature had rational basis for all sorts of reasons that are discussed in the brief for including that crime in the registry. The legislature, under rational basis review, can choose to have some generalizations and does not have to particularly take out and use a scaffold to define who can be and not be in that statute. For fundamental liberty interests, whether or not that statute can be constitutionally applied to people, then you look at individual people and very narrowly tailor the legislation and its application. For rational basis review, that's not required. So I guess the claim would be different. She's focused on, or Mr. Smith's focused on, the particular application of the law to him, but I guess I'm saying that he can only be considered, that question can only be analyzed in terms of how he fits in within the statutory scheme that the legislature chose to group him in. That makes sense.
So it's your position that this legislation provides that a defendant who is convicted of false imprisonment, whether or not there was any sexual aspect at all, in any event, motivation or anything, that that is a rational statute, as rational basis. Therefore, the particular facts of this case don't matter at all.
I think the precise question would be whether the legislature had a rational basis for making false imprisonment of a minor a mandatory registration statute.
Regardless of sexual issues.
Regardless of the underlying facts of the case, which in this case have not been proven.
And that's how you read the statute.
Pardon?
That's how you read the registry statute, that it says false imprisonment regardless of whether sexual matters are an issue.
What about if a Klan leader, let's say in a Klan leader in the Southeast Asian community in the state, didn't like the way that some younger kids were behaving, and they separated them, they kept them, they committed the elements of false imprisonment, not for any kind of sexual intention, but because the student was not living according to the traditions of the family, and the Klan leader was not a parent. And that Klan leader were prosecuted, would that Klan leader have to file as a sex in the sex registry?
Yes, he would.
Counsel, could you talk about the waiver argument a little bit before your time is up?
My plea waiver?
Right.
I think as-applied challenges, which he is raising, are not jurisdictional claims. So there's case law that says you waive it if you plead no contest or guilty, and that's what he did.
His plea forfeited it. Is that your point?
Plea forfeited it when he pled guilty to the recording statute violation.
Do you think we took this case to have it waived?
No, which is why I didn't spend much time on it.
It's one paragraph at the bottom of a five.
Right. I guess I'd like to leave this court with 3 points. One, I believe that the state set forth rational reasons why the legislature could require false imprisonment on the list of crimes for which registration is mandatory. Number two, the version of as-applied challenges that would focus on individual people is at odds with rational basis case law. And number three, even if you were going to accept that as-applied challenges were going to look specifically at the facts of Mr. Smith's case, there'd A, be the factual problem that the facts in this case have never been developed fully, and the burden is on him to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that he shouldn't have to register. And number two would be all the practical issues that will arise, improved issues that will arise in future cases if you were to follow that formulation of rational basis review.
No, we didn't have a trial, so the facts were not developed at a trial. But there was a plea colloquy, I'm assuming. And the plea colloquy is supposed to state facts from which a court can find the person guilty.
I guess there's two issues. One, if you were if you're having a plea colloquy on a case without a sexual element, you wouldn't necessarily get into the sexual facts of the crime. Number two, there's a case, State v. Martel, which I found interesting. In that case, they said the state or court couldn't impose. The defendant in that case was convicted of bail jumping, but there'd been a sexual act or sexual crime that had been in the complaint and just been read into the record. The judge could not order sex offender registration based on the lead-in offense, and in a way that's what Smith's trying to do. He's trying to take allegations or information and say something's not in the criminal complaint, therefore there's no facts about that, therefore it's not rational to make me register.
Thank you, counsel.
right. Counselor, before you get a chance even to open your mouth, I'd like to ask you is, if in section 301.45.1d.b, which defines sex offense, if before the last phrase, and if you take a minute to get the statute, I'm looking at the last or in the statute. It says or of section 930 or 930.31. Do you see where I am?
Correct.
Okay, so if after those two statutory references, the statute read, which are not required to have a sexual component, and then it goes on as it did now, would you still be here arguing to us that your client has an as-applied challenge?
I would, yes.
Wow.
Well, the state, the legislature can define terms however it wishes, but like any other law, the definition of its terms has to be rational. The term sex offense has a meaning outside of the statute, and that's, it's a kind of offense. I mean, even within the statute, it's a kind of offense. If the legislature chose to define homicide by a person spitting on the sidewalk, well, it can choose to make that definition, but that would be, at least I would argue, irrational, just like it's irrational here if the court is explicitly defining a sex offense to include something that is absolutely not a sex offense. Now, in this case,
it's not absolutely that it's not. I think that all would agree there are many times when kidnapping really does have a sexual component. And all I'm saying to you is that the legislature is specifically stating that it may not have a sexual component, or it may have a sexual component, but there still is a registration requirement.
Correct. I don't think that would alter the claim in this case.
Why? Why not?
Pardon?
Why not?
Well, I think that implicit in the statute as it is anyone who commits these two crimes. So it does, by its terms, include someone like Mr. Smith, who did not commit any sexually motivated crime.
So you're saying the legislature can't have kidnapping and false imprisonment as a required registration crime because sometimes they don't include sexual offenses?
No, absolutely not. That would be, again, a facial claim. We are only talking, it's a very narrow claim. We're talking about Mr. Smith and people with claims that are identical to his.
I understand that exactly, but I do think opposing counsel makes a good point when she says what you're really asking for is strict scrutiny, a statute that is narrowly tailored to achieve the state's purpose. Well, under your argument, the state's purpose is to have registration of folks that have committed sexual offenses in the past. But if you broaden that at all to say the state could have a valid purpose of causing those to register who have committed crimes of violence against children, which is where the federal requirements started out, then I'm not sure why there would be a problem with my suggested change.
Well, I want to talk about a couple things here. I wanted to get to the state is essentially saying, if you bring any as-applied challenge in a case not involving a fundamental right, you're talking about strict scrutiny. The state is essentially trying to eliminate as-applied challenges in cases involving the rational basis test. Well, this court has certainly never limited it that way, and neither have other courts. In Mr. Smith's briefs, there are several cases involving as-applied challenges to cases where we're talking about rational basis review. That includes Robinson, Small, Hofshire, the equal protection case in California, Guidry, the Hawaii Supreme Court involving a substantive due process. And then you can even look at the United States Supreme Court cases. I noticed that in the, I apologize, I don't have the citation to this, but the Glucksberg case on the right to die, At one point, the court says, you know, if somebody came back with a particular as-applied challenge, then we might decide things differently. And that was a case involving the rational basis review I forget the exact facts of the case, but it was on the right to die. And I think we have to distinguish here between the level of scrutiny. I see that my time is up. Should I
finish your sentence?
Okay. Between the level of scrutiny, which is about the fit between the application and the objective, and separately about the number of people it affects. In a facial challenge, it has to irrationally affect every single individual it applies to. The constitutional rights are individual rights. And an as-applied challenge goes to whether any law is irrational as applied to that individual.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Fite. Thank you, Ms. St. John, for your excellent arguments today on equal protection, substantive due process in a criminal case involving the sexual registry. That concludes our hearing in 08AP1011CR. State v. Smith. Court will reconvene at 1:30 to hear a third argument. Students who can stay should wait.